content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 23/May 30, 2022. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow inner white border. The background of the cover today is shades of blue. It looks like a pathway of icy blue leading from the foreground into the background, where this pathway of icy blue blends into horizontal stripes of blue, which ends up at a horizon of deeper blue. Time, the word, is superimposed in heavy black lettering, all capitals, quite large, upon this light blue background. It says the cold truth. Beginning then with For the Record. This is not a war of two armies. It is a war of two world views. The quotation from Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine, in a recorded address to Ukrainians, May 9, Victory Day, which celebrates the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany. Deeply honored, beyond excited, and of course a little bit scared, stated by Nakuti Gatwa, sex education actor, after being named the first black Doctor Who, May 8. He looked great in the house while I had him, said Laura Young, a Texas art collector, to the AP. May 6, after a statue she bought for $34.99 at Goodwill, was identified as a 2,000-year-old bust of a Roman general missing from a German museum since World War II. $803,650, the amount raised from an online auction of items owned by the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, including a silver tea set. Profits went to the Washington National Opera. I believe we bear a moral responsibility to do what we can to address the persistent corrosive effects of those historical practices, stated by Lawrence Bacow, B-A-C-O-W, Harvard president, in a letter to the school's community, addressing an April 26 report issued by the university that revealed its historical links to slavery. $300 million, value of a yacht owned by a Russian oligarch seized by Fiji, May 5, on behalf of the U.S., which imposed sanctions after the invasion of Ukraine. Her Majesty's government will, stated Prince Charles, reading out the U.K. government's agenda at the opening of Parliament, May 10. It was almost the first time in it was the first time in almost six decades that Queen Elizabeth was not present. Beneath the heading Climate, here is an essay, A Truth as Cold as Ice. After visiting both ends of the earth, I realized how much trouble we're in, by Aryn, A-R-Y-N, Baker. And this is referencing The Covers, The Cold Truth headline. Nothing on Earth compares with the icy sweeps of the planet's polar extremes. It is why, perhaps, explorers and scientists who've been there often seek more distant analogies. describing the pole's austere swaths of frozen terrain in lunar terms, unworldly, with their slimmed-down palettes of white, black, and icy blues. Home only to the most exquisitely adapted organisms, the Arctic and Antarctic are largely lethal to humankind, unforgiving with their dark winters, harsh winds, and violent cold. Yet these remote, inhospitable places have more impact on our lives than almost anything closer to home. The poles regulate our climate, our weather patterns, even our maritime food supply. And they're warming faster than anywhere else on Earth, with untold consequences for those who live at the planet's more accommodating latitudes. Here's a photo. It's in lovely colors. It's not very large. It is captioned Baker, the author of this article. Baker on the banks of Alaska's Unalakleet River, Unalakleet, September 17, 2021. She is bundled up in a blue parka with light blue gloves, with dark pants, and it looks like brown hiking boots. She's got a brown scarf and a brown hat. She's looking off towards the horizon, which in fact is clouded. It has shards of blue spiking through the clouds, beneath which is a mountain range. And then the river itself is surrounded by probably marsh areas. It's a brownish green landscape, and it just kind of folds itself in and out of the river. It's flat there. It's flat very far back until one sees those mountain range peaks at the horizon. Returning now to the text, I saw this firsthand February 6, 2020, when Antarctica logged its hottest temperature on record, the hottest temperature on record, 18.3 degrees centigrade, or 64.9 degrees Fahrenheit, at Argentina's Esperanza weather station. I was on nearby Anvers Island, accompanying a team of ornithologists from New York's Stony Brook University, conducting a census of the region's chinstrap penguin population. Members of the expedition relished the balmy weather, stripping down to t-shirts, but it was an ominous sign for the species they were there to document. Penguins are not just adorable icons of Antarctica. They are a sentinel species, an animal whose behaviors can tell scientists if something's going wrong in a particular environment. Chinstraps feed mainly on krill, tiny crustaceans that are the foundation of the maritime food chain. Almost every animal in the ocean eats either krill or something else that eats krill, all the way up to the tuna that ends up on our dinner tables. Krill feed on the algae and phytoplankton that cling to the underside of ocean ice. As global temperatures rise because of increased carbon emissions, sea ice is declining. It would be impossible to survey the health of the world's krill population. But if chinstraps are not doing well, it's likely that krill and everything that eats krill are not doing well either. And our carbon canaries are not doing well. Stony Brook researchers found most of the chinstrap colonies had declined over the past 50 years, some by half, others by up to 77%. We can wring our hands over the looming loss of a charismatic species, but Save the Penguins, Use Solar does not go far enough as a slogan. It does not fully encompass what the loss of this penguin species portends for the future of humanity on this planet. Climate change moves so slowly as to feel almost imperceptible to us. What difference, after all, does a fraction of a single degree make on our day-to-day lives? But lay that trajectory over something more fragile and less resilient, like chinstraps, it quickly becomes clear the domino effect of climate change is already starting to reach uncomfortably close to home. or at least it should, there is an incomprehensible disconnect between what climate science says must be done, an immediate shift in how we produce energy, travel, and eat, and what we and our leaders are willing to do. At what point does the distant threat of ecological collapse assume the fierce urgency of now, when the sea ice is entirely gone? When the penguins are? By then it will be too late. The Arctic is nearing that tipping point. Nearly 5 months after Antarctica's high temperature record, the Siberian city of Verkhoyansk reached a searing, historic high of 38 degrees centigrade, 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit, June 20, 2020, heralding a summer of extreme heat and wildfires in a region better known for ice storms. Overall, 2020 marked the hottest year on record for both poles, and both the Arctic and the Antarctic saw precipitous declines in sea ice. When there isn't enough ice to reflect the sun's rays back into space, the heat's absorbed by the dark ocean, accelerating rising water temperatures and ice melt, altering ocean currents, weakening the jet stream, changing wind patterns. The effects ripple through the global ecosystem, manifesting in greater drought, heat, floods, and storms. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic, Admiral Carl L. Schultz, commander of the U.S. Coast Guard, told me on a September 2021 visit to the Canadian Arctic outpost of Resolute. Hurricane Ida had just ripped through the Caribbean and parts of the U.S., killing 107 from Venezuela to Connecticut and costing more than $75 billion in damage. While Resolute seemed worlds away from the destruction left in Ida's wake, the two were opposite sides of the same coin, Schultz said. Ida was a tropical storm that exploded into a hurricane with little warning, the kind of rapid intensification caused by a warming Arctic and a harbinger of more to come. What happens at the top of the planet matters to everyone on Earth, but it matters most to those who live there. A lack of sea ice exposes vulnerable shorelines to rapid erosion, forcing indigenous villages that have lived in harmony with the Arctic's extremes for centuries to relocate inland. Hunting for seal, walrus, and polar bear, a mainstay of native Arctic traditions and subsistence survival, is not possible without winter's thick slabs of ice. For many communities on the edge, the loss of sea ice spells cultural disruption, as well as dislocation, in a preview of what global warming, if left unchecked, will eventually bring to the rest of the world. A few weeks after leaving Resolute, I traveled to the village of Unalaklit on Alaska's northwest coast to meet Lorelei Ivanov, an Inupiaq climate activist. Ivanov's home freezer was full of the wealth of Arctic Alaska's short summer season, berries and tundra greens, wild rhubarb, salmon caviar, caribou fat, bear meat. The one thing she does not have is the food that sustained her culture for generations, ugruk, or bearded seal. When a seal is harvested, every part of the animal is used, from the fat to the skin and intestines. It anchors the hunter in a community ritual of sharing and respect for nature. When Ivanov was a child, ice formed in the early fall and stayed deep into spring. These days, she wonders if she will see ice at all in coming years. Colonization and assimilation have taken away so much, Ivanov told me, including language, dancing, and ceremonies that bound the community together. All that's left is the native food traditions, and now climate change is taking even that. She watched her three-year-old son play on the floor as he took a toy boat on an imaginary ugruk hunt. How much of his culture will he get to keep? A fundamental part of human nature is to want to pass something on to the next generation that symbolizes our values, be it a cultural tradition or material goods earned over a lifetime of labor. If my daughter inherits a damaged planet racked by heat waves, befouled with plastic tide, and witness to waves of climate migrants fleeing uninhabitable lands, what does that say about the values my generation cultivated in its dogged pursuit of perpetual growth? The science is clear. To prevent climate devastation, we must cut greenhouse emissions nearly in half by 2030, compared with 2010 levels. That means real sacrifice in the short term, especially for those of us lucky enough to live in highly developed parts of the world. At this point, prioritizing the climate offers a stronger guarantee for the future than continuing to accumulate wealth the way we have been. I came away from both polls with a mounting sense of frustration over a global unwillingness to act in the face of certain doom, as well as fear. A warming Arctic is not just a warning. It has the potential to take us with it in its demise. Permafrost, the layer of permanently frozen ground that undergirds both poles, is a carbon bomb waiting to go off. As the soil thaws, it releases greenhouse gases, warming the region further and setting off a perpetual feedback loop. Scientists do not yet know if Arctic emissions are on par with a small developing nation, or more likely, another China. The South Pole's permafrost is trapped under the Antarctic ice sheet. If that melts away, we have bigger things to worry about, like a 200-foot sea level rise. We tend to think of the Earth's polar regions as victims of our own carbon profligacy, but if we push them past the tipping point, they will become perpetrators. Our polar regions protect life as we know it, only as much as we protect them. It is worth sacrificing a little bit more to ensure we leave a better world behind. From the news ticker, three short items. Al Jazeera journalist fatally shot. Veteran Palestinian-American correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh was fatally shot in the head by Israeli forces while reporting, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry and Al Jazeera. The network alleged a blatant murder. Israeli officials suggested the fire was Palestinian. New boss takes power in Hong Kong. Former Hong Kong police official John Lee, who helped lead the crackdown on 2019 pro-democracy protests, was elected May 8 as the territory's chief executive. In a statement, foreign ministers of the G7 nations raised concerns about the election process and the steady erosion of political and civil rights and Hong Kong's autonomy. Unrest continues in Sri Lanka. After weeks-long protests in response to an economic crisis turned violent, May 10, the Defense Ministry ordered troops to shoot protesters who threatened people or property. Meanwhile, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's home was set on fire, and his brother resigned as premier. The Bulletin, The Meaning of the Marcos Family's Return to Power. This is by Chad de Guzman. Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., son of the Philippines' late dictator, is set to become the country's next president. The almost 31 million votes tallied for the 64-year-old Marcos by May 10 was more than double those for his closest rival, with only 3% of the vote uncounted. Marcos's father, Ferdinand Marcos Sr., ruled the Southeast Asian nation of 110 million for 21 years before being ousted in 1986. The elder Marcos tore up presidential term limits, imposed 9 years of martial law, and brutally quashed political dissent jailing and killing thousands of his opponents. He and his wife Imelda embezzled as much as up to $10 billion from state coffers. A citizen uprising drove the family into exile in Hawaii, where the elder Marcus died in 1989. Experts say the Marcus family's comeback reflects voters' frustration at the failure of successive governments to alleviate long-standing problems like poverty. Misinformation on social networks helped to whitewash the family, as did the youthful electorate. Some 56% of voters were either not yet born or small children when Marcos Jr.'s father was in power. By choosing Sara Duterte Carpio, daughter of outgoing President Rodrigo Duterte, as his running mate, Marcos also united the political machinery of the two most prominent dynasties. Critics fear Marcos will continue whitewashing the past by exerting authority over institutions that are investigating his family's ill-gotten wealth. He will also have the power to appoint the head of the country's Human Rights Commission, despite his previous attempts to create doubt over well-documented rights violations during his father's rule. The dynastic nature of Philippine politics will also become more entrenched. Rights advocate Antonio Lavinia says Marcos' victory is about cementing the ruling class. All right, here is a photograph of horses, not just large, beautiful horses, but they're running. They're running on a dirt track in front of a stadium, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 tiers of spectators in the stadium. Some of the riders are in red and white. One is in blue and white. Another one behind that one I can't see. They're wearing helmets. The horses are well bridled, and it's entitled The Longest Shot, Rich Strike. His saddle blanket shows his name. He's a beautiful brown horse, extremely muscular, hooves flying in the air. He was an 80-1 outsider, and he won the Kentucky Derby May 7 in one of the biggest underdog victories in racing history. The horse was only admitted to the race at the last minute after a competitor had dropped out. Rich Strike was in 18th place at one point in the race, but kept his pace to take the victory as others flared out. Ask the horse's owner, Rick Dawson, after the race, what planet is this? How Depp defenders took over TikTok, by Chris Stokel Walker. Johnny Depp's fans are flooding TikTok with videos supporting the star and denigrating his ex-wife, Amber Heard. There's a photo here. It's a bit blurry. There are heads of people in the foreground, and they're blurry. We see a blonde wearing blue and somebody else with brown hair wearing dark blue. But looking at the camera, not quite, but close, is Johnny Depp himself. Dark hair slicked back, wearing Clark Gable-style sunglasses, neatly trimmed facial hair. We see only his head and the very top of his shoulders. He's wearing a dark jacket, white shirt, and a dark blue tie. I think there's an earring dangling from his right ear. If you have opened TikTok recently, you will have struggled to escape commentary or clips from the defamation trial brought by Johnny Depp against his ex-wife, Amber Heard, in a Virginia courtroom. The trial, over an opinion piece about domestic violence that Heard wrote for the Washington Post in 2018, in which Depp claims she defamed him, has become unavoidable on TikTok. There are regular updates from the courtroom from both established news outlets and rank-and-file users, clipping key moments and adding their opinions. Videos tagged with hashtags Johnny Depp and Justice for Johnny Depp have collected billions of views. Despite no shortage of news happening around the world, the Depp-Heard trial seems to dominate TikTok, with most videos supporting Depp and denigrating Heard. TikTok representatives declined to speak for the story, but plenty of those who monitor the app have theories as to why videos supporting Depp have taken over TikTok. TikTok is always a great amplifier for cultural moments, says Abby Richards, a research fellow at the Accelerationism Research Consortium and a mis- and disinformation researcher who specializes in how content travels on TikTok. If you engage with one video about the topic, the algorithm learns that you like it and will continue to feed you similar videos. Several news networks have hosted TikTok live streams covering what unfolds each day in the courtroom, which increases awareness of and engagement with the trial. That triggers a gold rush for other creators to participate in a conversation that appears to be dominating the app, creating a flywheel of more content. One of the key commodities on TikTok is the virality of its memes. Users see a particular type of video or a certain piece of audio and produce something similar in order to try and capitalize on its popularity. In this instance, the trial itself has become a meme. Whether you're part of Depp's fan base or not, the rush to join the conversation about Depp is highly motivated by algorithmic amplification and the golden ticket to the For You page, says Tom Divan, visual communication researcher at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. There's also the fact that Depp is highly beloved by his digital fan base. What we are seeing at play is the anger against Amber Heard has a couple of layers, says Georgie Carroll, an Australian academic who studies the relationship between online creators and their audience. This is not something that's representative of all fans or fandom, but we do always see a certain level of dislike and distrust leveled against the partners of popular male celebrities. Fans often think a female partner is not good enough for their favorite celebrity, or hold on to a far-off hope that it should actually be them. Besides the viral momentum of a live news event that many feel they have a stake in, featuring highly recognizable celebrities with devoted fan bases, the Depp-Heard trial also taps into a third accelerant to guarantee its success, cyber sleuthing TikTok. While the idea of amateur sleuths using the internet to collaborate on research projects has been around for years, the movement has been fueled by the snackable, immersive nature of TikTok videos. Perhaps most famously, TikTok users claim credit for helping to discover the body of Gabby Petito after she disappeared in August 2021. TikTok sleuths pored over available open source evidence claiming that Petito's fiancé, Brian Laundry, was responsible for her murder. A similar impetus drove TikTok's crowdsourced investigation of West Elm Caleb, a New York furniture designer alleged to have ghosted several women, and it appears to be in part responsible for perpetuating content around the Depp-Heard trial. The phenomenon of West Elm Caleb was not just that a few girls posted about their experiences with him. It was the snowballing of those posts, then posts about it, then memes, then meta-memes about the memes, then articles and discourse off the app, says Richards. The thing spirals into a massive cultural moment. That's happening around this trial, too. Users are exchanging pet theories about someone who looks like Heard's attorney, Elaine Bredehoft, appearing in the crowd at an event for Depp's 2013 movie, The Lone Ranger. A video outlining the theory has been viewed millions of times. The scale of content is understandable, says Carroll. When a celebrity is involved in a controversy, regardless of whether something is alleged or proven, our modern social media sphere means there's immediately an immense pressure to renounce any affection you ever held for them, she says. Yet, as we are seeing, many are instead choosing to double down on their love of Depp, convinced that the course of the trial will demonstrate their favorite actor's innocence. Good question. What's behind the baby formula shortage? By Eloise Berry. Parents across the U.S. are scouring the internet and crossing state lines to get their hands on baby formula, as a national shortage has major retailers putting limits on the amount customers can buy. The crisis has worsened over the past few weeks, with 40% of popular formula brands sold out in late April, according to an analysis by Datassembly. More than half of formula products were completely sold out in several states, including Texas. And images shared online showed empty formula aisles across the country. Some eBay listings for infant formula were priced almost double normal retail costs. Specialty formulas for babies with allergies or special medical needs were even harder to find. There is no one reason for the shortage, showing that even the most essential items can fall through the cracks of strained global supply chains. Supply chain issues resulting from COVID-19, increased demand following the easing of pandemic restrictions, the war in Ukraine, and insufficient supplies of some commodities have all contributed, experts say. Panic buying further reduced stocks. But the problem was exacerbated when Abbott Laboratories, producer of top U.S. brand Similac, shut a major factory in Michigan and issued recalls in February over contamination concerns. According to the Food and Drug Administration, four babies got sick, including two who died, after being fed formula from the factory. In March, the FDA published preliminary findings that Abbott had failed to maintain sanitary conditions. However, Abbott says a separate FDA investigation found no traces of the bacteria linked to the illnesses in its formula. The company is the main supplier for families on state benefits. Abbott says it's working with the FDA to reopen its Michigan plant while increasing shipments from its factory in Ireland. But despite the fact that Reckitt, the maker of the second largest formula brand, already shipped 30% more product than usual in the first 3 months of 2022, the shortage remains. Did I mention Eloise Berry is the author of that? More from the news ticker. Musk would lift Trump's Twitter ban. Another three short articles here. Elon Musk said May 10, if he manages to buy Twitter, he would reverse the permanent suspension of former President Donald Trump's account, which the media company implemented after the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack. Musk called the ban morally wrong and stupid. Vaccine manufacturer deceived FDA. A House panel said May 10, government contractor Emergent Biosolutions concealed evidence from inspectors in the weeks before millions of Johnson & Johnson vaccines were contaminated and destroyed at a Baltimore plant, March 2021. No contaminated doses were distributed to the public. Escape ends with ex-jail officer's death. Vicky White, a former corrections officer accused of helping an accused murderer flee an Alabama jail, died after apparently shooting herself after police chased her in Indiana until her car crashed. Casey White, the suspect, who is unrelated, surrendered following the crash. Bridging food traditions, old and new. This is under the business caption. There's a photo here of two young women. It looks like they're in a food shop of some kind. Both are dark haired, dark eyed, wearing dark pants. Both are wearing t-shirts that say the same thing. Keep calm. I'm your food tour guide. I felt it was important to showcase this other side, says Arva Ahmed with her sister Farida. Vidya Balachander wrote this. Before Dubai transformed into a glittery global hub with an internationally culinary scene, there were limited, albeit much loved, dining options that represented the city's mix of influences. Sisters Arva and Farida Ahmed have fond memories of going for Friday night dinner with their parents to one of the city's Lebanese shawarma joints, Chai cafeterias or Chai cafeterias run by Indians from the Malabar coast, kebab joints, or the rare steakhouse. Everybody who grew up here knew only those five restaurants, says Arva. Clustered on either side of Dubai Creek, a saltwater stream that slices through the heart of the city, these restaurants represent old Dubai. The four neighborhoods that predate the skyscrapers that now define the skyline. Over the past 20 years, Dubai has experienced a burst of development and with it, a world-class dining scene. The city now boasts restaurants from some of the world's most well-known chefs, from Gordon Ramsay to Nobu Matsuhisa. After a brief halt in 2020 due to COVID-19 pandemic restrictions, new restaurants are opening and thriving. The good restaurants have thrived with a bumper 2021 of record revenues, and this year we're already witnessing a mammoth lineup of new openings, says Samantha Wood, a Dubai food critic and restaurant reviewer. The Michelin Guide announced it will debut in Dubai this year. But the foundations of Dubai's modern culinary diversity still lie in the neighborhoods. And the nondescript yet unique restaurants of the Ahmed sisters' childhood, something Arva always felt was missing from Dubai's marketing. There was a big gap in the way people were not talking about old Dubai, she says. I felt it was important to showcase this other side. In 2013, the sisters launched Frying Pan Adventures, a tour company that takes residents and travelers on immersive 3 to 4 hour long experiences along the bustling, unmanicured back streets of old Dubai to find culinary delights ranging from the best Pani Puri, a beloved street snack from the Indian subcontinent, to well-hidden falafel joints. The tour tells a story of the city's history and its food, weaving together a larger story about community, migration, and aspiration in a city that is at a global crossroads. The company was born out of Arva's own explorations to find the tastes of her childhood when she returned to the city in 2010 after living abroad. She felt unmoored by how much the city had changed and wanted to connect to her roots, blogging about her culinary adventures. I was so consumed by the idea of discovering and showing people the places that were not getting the light of day, she says. COVID-19 lockdowns and restrictions hit their business hard, with group size reduced from 12 to 6 people. But the sisters found creative ways to keep going, launching an online guidebook exploring the city's spice souk, and a podcast called Deep Fried that features Dubai food trends and local business owners. Both of these have given them the opportunity to reach people outside of Dubai. While there were fewer visitors from overseas to take their tours, Frying Pan has stoked newfound local interest, especially among the city's many expats, who are looking to understand more about the place where they live. Before the pandemic, 30% of our client base was Dubai residents, says Arva. That has now risen to nearly 60%. When you have that level of community, says Arva, it is hard to give up. Here is a page of milestones. Now, on this first article, I'm going to apologize in advance because I always mispronounce this name. The heading is One, W-O-N, Sinn Féin. It's S-I-N-N space F-E-I-N, Historic Election by Fintan O'Toole. O'Toole is author of We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. Sinn Féin won 29% of the vote in the Northern Ireland Assembly election May 3. The fact that it emerged from the election as the largest single party has a powerful symbolic resonance. Northern Ireland was established 101 years ago for one reason, to create a mini-state that would always be under the control of Protestants who wished to remain part of the UK. But history does not recognize always. Slow demographic change has made the number of Protestants and Catholics almost equal. The Democratic Unionist Party has been in deep trouble ever since it supported Brexit in 2016. Neither Scotland nor Northern Ireland voted to leave the EU, with Sinn Féin sure to use its new status to push for a plebiscite on whether Northern Ireland should leave the UK and join a united Ireland. It is ever more obvious that the repercussions of Brexit are very far from being done. Here's a photo in black and white of a young-looking singer. She has what they used to call high hair, although it's high on top and it's long in back. She's wearing a flouncy-looking white skirt and a top with long sleeves and lots of lace and sequin embellishment. She has a handheld mic in her left hand. It's dark in the background, but there are spotlights trained on her. The caption reads, Naomi Judd. Her silky harmonies helped make the Judds a success. Died, Naomi Judd, country superstar. This is written by Stephanie Zakarik. Just before the country music boom of the 1990s and the rise of that era's inescapable male hat acts, there were Naomi and Winona Judd, the mother-daughter duo who performed as the Judds. Their songs covered the usual country subjects of heartache and longing. But the very texture of their combined voices, Naomi's silky harmonies weaving a luminous net around Winona's bold, muscular vocals, also spoke of family bonds, of how a legacy of song can pass from one generation to the next. Naomi, who died April 30 at age 76, leaves behind not just her two daughters, Winona and actor Ashley Judd, but also a history of what it means to struggle with life's complexities. She was a gifted artist and a show business success, but she also knew what it was like to live with mental illness and to suffer beyond the reach of any country song. Naomi Judd raised her two daughters largely on her own, putting herself through nursing school. At 37, she quit nursing to pursue a career singing with Winona. landing a contract with RCA Curb in 1983. The duo released six studio albums between that year and 1990, garnering a string of number one hits, including Mama, He's Crazy, 1983, and Let Me Tell You About Love, 1989. Naomi left the duo in 1991 after being diagnosed with hepatitis C. Her death, which her family said was due to the disease of mental illness, came the night before the Judds were to be inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, capping off a rich but bittersweet life and career. Here's a footnote. You can reach the National Alliance on Mental Illness helpline at 800-950-NAMI. Here's another small bar of milestones beneath those two major articles. Sentence, tennis star Boris Becker, April 29, to 2.5 years in prison for bankruptcy offenses, including hiding assets, by a judge in London. Splattered, Russian ambassador to Poland, Sergei Andreev, with red paint, by protesters opposed to the war in Ukraine, at a World War II cemetery, May 9. Auctioned, Andy Warhol's iconic Shot Sage Blue Marilyn for $195 million, May 9, the most for a work by a U.S. artist sold at an auction. Underway, the Paris trial of Yemen's main airline, May 10, on charges relating to a 2009 plane crash that led to 152 deaths. Died Indian classical music legend Shiv Kumar Sharma, who elevated the santoor, a dulcimer-like instrument, at the age of 84, May 10, upheld a limit on California's ban on foie gras, allowing residents to buy fattened liver produced out of state, a court ruled, May 6. Prepping for a post-Roe world, a leaked Supreme Court draft which threatens the national right to an abortion has all sides braced for impact, by Abigail Abrams. This is under the heading Nation. In the 49 years since the U.S. Supreme Court established a constitutional right to abortion, the experience of being a woman in this country has transformed. Birth control access has expanded, and more women have entered the workforce, pursued higher education, won protections from being fired for getting pregnant, and become breadwinners. Through it all, abortion has remained one of the nation's most fraught topics. While support for legal abortion has mostly gone unchanged, about 60% of Americans believe it should be legal in most or all cases, so has opposition to the procedure. Since the early 70s, activists and lawmakers who believe abortion is immoral have waged a long, careful battle in state legislatures and the courts in hopes that one day the Supreme Court would overturn Roe v. Wade. May 2, it seemed that day was imminent. A leaked draft opinion on Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, a case directly challenging existing precedent, showed the majority of justices poised to overturn Roe in its entirety. The news landed like a bomb. Within hours, protesters on both sides of the debate crowded outside the Supreme Court building in Washington, dancing in triumph or shaking with rage. Pastors declared victory. Politicians sprinted to stake positions. Lawyers scrambled to understand the extraordinary implications of the draft text, pointing to a list of other constitutional rights suddenly in jeopardy, including access to birth control and the ability to marry the person of your choice, regardless of sex or race. While the opinion leaked to Politico may well change before a final version is released, likely in June, its mere existence reshaped American politics in an instant, upending midterm races and political agendas and refuting any argument that overturning Roe would affect only a small number of people in conservative states. The fierce and immediate political fallout made clear that any Supreme Court decision changing the precedent that Roe set will affect us all. For many liberals, the draft marked the worst-case scenario, the doomsday outcome they'd been warning about for years. It is devastating, but it's also a critical wake-up call. Minnie Timuraju, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, told reporters, "The day after the draft appeared, NARAL, N-A-R-A-L, saw a 1,403% increase in donations. Planned Parenthood reported a 650% uptick in donations and engagement. Democratic fundraising platform Act Blue raised $12 million in the 24 hours after draft was made public. And the Abortion Care Network, which supports independent abortion clinics nationwide, raised $250,000 in the first 3 days after the leak from more than 12,000 donors, about 95% of whom were new. Abortion providers also reported a flood of patients seeking birth control appointments, hoping to stockpile emergency contraception, or asking to proactively order abortion pills. Just 16 states and Washington, D.C. have laws on their books that explicitly protect abortion rights, should Roe cease to be the law of the land. For conservatives, the draft decision was cause for celebration. If this is the opinion of the court, it will be one of the greatest opinions in Supreme Court history. It will save millions of lives," Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri tweeted May 3. The draft was seen as validation of both conservative strategy and their core belief that Roe was wrongly decided and that the only way to redress that error was to deliver conservatives onto the highest court. Social media, religious leaders thanked former President Donald Trump, whose three Supreme Court appointments brought this moment to fruition. If the court's final opinion is similar to the leaked draft, 13 states with trigger laws will ban abortion almost immediately. At least 10 more are likely to implement abortion bans or restrictions soon after. In the days after the draft's publication, many national Republicans focused on condemning the leak rather than addressing the substance of the draft, as political strategists debated the political risk of opposing a procedure that the majority of Americans support in some form. A leaked memo from the National Republican Senatorial Committee advised candidates that our position should be based in compassion and reason, and emphasized Republicans do not want to throw doctors and women in jail. But at the same time, some GOP members of Congress also floated passing a national abortion ban. The real action was in the states, where Republican legislators rushed to ready abortion bans, advanced criminal penalties for performing abortions, and considered defining life as starting at conception, a move that carries major implications for everything from miscarriages to contraception, like intrauterine devices, IUDs, to the so-called morning after pill. No more compromises, no more waiting, says Brian Gunter, a pastor who helped write a Louisiana bill classifying abortion as homicide. In Georgia, State Representative Ed Setzler, who sponsored a 2019 abortion ban, cheered his colleagues' ambitions. "I think perhaps we're coming to a place where we recognize the deep brutality of Roe v. Wade," he told Time. "Maybe coming to an end." For the average American not tuned in to the nuances of state and federal political battles, the leak mostly produced a cloud of confusion. Abortion rights advocates rushed to assure patients while simultaneously pushing out information about what may come next. If the Supreme Court does indeed overturn Roe, many expect that abortion pills, which can be prescribed via telehealth and sent in the mail, will become the next arena of legal and legislative warfare. Others point to the likelihood that the nation will be split in half, with Democrat-led states seeing an influx of out-of-state patients seeking abortions within their borders. Several Democratic state legislatures have moved to protect providers and out-of-state patients and to allocate money to help pay for their care. Katie Quinonez, executive director of West Virginia's only abortion clinic, says if her state makes the procedure illegal, she and her staff will help more patients travel to Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. In the age of the Internet, we are unlikely to return to the back-alley abortions of the pre-Roe era. But that, Quinonez says, is not the same as having access to legal care. Many would-be patients in places where abortion is illegal will likely struggle to take time off work, find transportation, or arrange child care to get an abortion. Studies show that people who are denied abortions have worse mental health, more physical health issues, including pregnancy-related death, higher rates of poverty and debt, and less financial security. Most people who seek abortions already have at least one child. The U.S., which has the highest maternal mortality rate of any wealthy nation, is also unique among its peer nations in failing to provide robust, state-funded child care, paid family leave, or other parental support. While the country, awash in uncertainty, awaits the court's final ruling, one thing is now clear. The U.S. is on the cusp of a monumental shift in which issues surrounding women's autonomy, privacy, and the government's role in its citizens' health will become central to our lives and our politics. The justices' final decision will shape not only reproductive rights, but also the health care system, criminal justice, workforce participation, and what it means to create a family in America. That article was written by Abigail Abrams, with reporting by Nick Popley, Washington. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.